Morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for the warm welcome. It's a pleasure for me to join you here today, and it is also an impressive list of speakers and panelists, and I think it's very exciting to be part of it. I have already had the chance, the possibility to visit the United States quite a few times. And every visit, I have to tell you, feels some sort like an adventure. And I have the sense, actually, particularly strong today here in St. Louis, the gateway city, from which Louis and Clark started exploring the West back in 1804. I've been looking forward very much to do some exploring with you as well, not of the West, of course, but of the new frontiers within the agricultural policy. Prosperity is a very good choice of a topic. I suppose most people think that prosperity is a very good thing. But it's sometimes, I feel it is a bit strangely controversial when we try to connect prosperity to agriculture. There seem to be people out there that think that if a farmer is rich, he must have been doing something very bad, mistreating his pigs, or using enough herbicides to kill a whole rainforest. But some of the same people also seem to think that if a farmer is not rich, he's probably still doing something bad, relying on the state for hands out. On this basis, farmers are damned if they are prosperous, and they are damned if they are not prosperous. Thankfully, a negative and uninformed views like these are not universal. But I think they underline two different and very important things. On the one hand, farmers want to make money. I can tell you that when I was a farmer, I certainly did my utmost to do so. But on the other hand, farming is not a purely economic activity. It has a significant impact on our world, so we must ensure that when we make money, we also make money the right way. And there are the main points that I would like to look into today. So where should I actually start? Well, there's, of course, here in Missouri, the show-me state. So let me start with money and show you how the common agricultural policy in Europe helps the farmers to earn their money. And what is the natural way of making money? Of course, by going to the marketplace with the products, with the goods that people want to buy. This, I think, is a very obvious point, but it's not automatically reflected in the different agricultural policies. So when making policy, we decide to what extent it runs with the grain of market principles. I want to tell you today that contrary to what some people believe, the European Union's Common Agricultural Policy, the CAP as we normally call it, has a very large dose of market principles in its makeup. As I've explained during previous visits to the United States, the core of the Common Agricultural Policy used to be price support. That was the old-fashioned system. And there were, of course, reasons for this. Reasons that was rooted specifically in the situation in Europe after the Second World War, a period where we were in lack of food supply within the European Union. Over time, we have moved away from price support and towards direct payment to farmers, and this direct payment was linked to the production. This made the public spending in agriculture, of course, more transparent, but the payment continued to influence on the choices of the farmers when they decided the planning for their farms. So we have now taken another giant step forward. Under a fundamental set of reforms that took place in 2003 and onwards, the decoupling was introduced. And this means that there's no longer any link between what the farmer produces and the money and the money he or she gets. And we have a situation, or will have a situation by 2010, within 3 years, that 90% of the direct payment to the farmers will be decoupled from the payment. But these money are not for free for the farmers. They are a linkage of strict rules to be able to receive these money. But I'll return to this point later. But first, emphasize the value of the decoupling itself. We had the prosperity of our farm sector very, very much in mind when we introduced this new system of decoupling. We think that farmers make much better production decisions when those decisions are guided by what the market wants, instead of by a matrix of subsidy policies from Brussels. And we think it's also essential that you have a long-term financial sustainability. So better production decisions can simply mean producing one basic commodity rather than another on the basis of hard-hearted assessments of market prospects. It also clearly supports diversification in the rural areas, because in many rural areas, farming have no longer the power to keep on the economy in these rural areas. I should also add that the European Union's research budget makes a large contribution to try to encourage technological innovation and also economic understanding. As I have said, we want an agricultural policy that unleashes farmers' energy within the marketplace. But that cannot be the only goal of our policies. Farmland makes up to 80% of the surface of the European Union. It includes some of the most beautiful landscapes. So when farmers do their job well, they therefore create essential public goods, clean air, clean water, places for rest, places for recreation, for just to mention some. And farming also generates vast products. And in many cases, it involves animals and it involves people. Overall, its impact on us goes well beyond its apparent contribution to the gross domestic product. And this is why European citizens say that they expect farmers to be responsible with regard to our natural environment, to animal welfare, to food safety, and of course also to labor standards. we have found a way of integrating this need for responsibility into the new decoupled system. The main tool for doing this is the introduction of a new word, namely cross-compliance. No one, I'm quite sure, would claim that this is especially elegant expression, but the reality behind this new cross-compliance is very important. Under this new system, farmers, the decoupled payment that farmers receive can actually be cut down to zero if they do not respect these high standards of environmental care, of animal welfare, and also of public health. And this gives a strong incentive. I mean, money is sometimes a very strong incentive to the farmers to deliver what the public actually expects from farming. Cross-compliance helps to ensure a baseline of standards. Where farmers and other land managers want to go beyond this baseline by making a special effort, for example, within the environment, they can receive financial support for this during our rural development policy. So with the help of these essential tools, decoupled payment, cross-compliance, and rural development policy, we think that we are at the least moving towards a good balance between prosperity and responsibility. But of course, we have to achieve this balance in the context where a proportion of the European Union's food and agricultural raw materials are imported and will continue to be imported. And of course, this presents a certain challenge. In principle, we are clearly in favor of trade liberalization at the right pace and under the right conditions. It opens up new possibilities, new opportunities for wealth creation. But the conditions are, of course, important. European farmers often point out that in areas such as environment, such as animal welfare, they are subject, or they have to live with standards that goes far beyond those that are applied in many other countries. And this means very often they have to accept a higher cost of production and therefore work on a playing field which is tilted against them. In this respect, of course, we want a level playing field. And this phrase is used to refer to a number of issues in international trade discussions. Why should standards like this not be part of our discussions? We normally call it the non-trade concerns. If we can look for international consensus on things like maximum level of agricultural subsidy or caps on different tariffs, why should we also not look for consensus about standards? The issue cannot be permanently airbrushed out of the picture, as some, of course, have a certain interest to do. So while I'm on the object of trade, I would just touch, of course, also on the Doha round with some more general remarks. Right now, I feel, and I'm quite sure that many with me feel, that the going is rather heavy. But at least we have a clear process mapped out ahead of us. There are actually technical work to be done, and of course we must do it well. And at the same time, politically, we have to show that we are not quitters. We must stick with this until we get a result. The European Union wants this Doha round to be successful, especially for the sake of the developing countries. We have actually proved our commitment to the development again and again in the past through our different aid programs, our partnership agreements, and the preferential trade arrangements, such as the Everything But Arms agreement from 2001. And this agreement means that the 49 poorest countries in the world are allowed access into the European Union at zero duty, at zero limitation in the exports. I think this is crucial. And we are just now negotiating with the rest, you can say, of the ACP countries that are not EBA countries, the 36 more wealthy countries. And we are, I think, close to a final discussion with them with a system that is more or less in the same ball game as what we have done with the poorest countries in the world, namely free access to the European market. This opening up markets clearly means that Europe today is by far the biggest importer of agricultural commodities from the poor countries in the world. We import more than Canada, America, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan altogether. So I think we have shown the way, and trade is of crucial importance. So a success in the Doha round, of course it will have to build on the compromise, but I think it's important as well that there must be something for everyone in the final compromise. Commentaries may strike rhetorical poses, calling some sides good and some sides bad. But at the end of the day, they are not the ones who will make the deal around the table. So therefore, we need balance in agriculture. We need balance in agriculture compared to the non-agricultural products, namely the industrial products, and in services. I think those two latter ones have been neglected shamefully in the discussions. If at the political level WTO member states can set their minds together on such a balanced overall agreement, then I think we have a possibility for a gain for everybody, and success should only be a matter of time. On the other hand, some parties involved set their sights unrealistically high, and there could be a chance, a danger, I would rather say, that we would all go back from these negotiations very disappointed. So I think we should all do an extraordinary effort in the window of opportunities that's still left for these negotiations. Having moved from the domestic to the international topics, let me just close with an issue that has a particular high importance politically in Europe just now, but which has also captured attention in many other parts of the world, not in the least here in the United States, and this is bioenergy and biofuels. Plainly, the subject has relevance to our topic, our discussion on prosperity. It also has a huge relevance to public concern. I think hardly one week can pass without me seeing a TV news item with images of glaciers that are completely collapsing, islands that are sinking into the ocean. So global warming is moving quickly on the international agenda. In the European Union, we are trying to be ambitious, but of course also realistic. Bioenergy and biofuels do offer market opportunities, and they are part of the solution to a number of different problems. But there are no panacea, and we must be aware of the possible consequences of significantly raising the production and the use. European leaders had these points very much in mind when they presented on the 10th of January a whole package for energy targeting the year 2020. First of all, the European Union committed itself to reduce their emission of greenhouse gas by 20% and even by 30% if we could secure that other developed countries could match this offer. And of course, the United States would be one of them. So 30% emission reduction by 2020. Secondly, to obtain 20% of our energy needs from renewable energies also by 2020. And thirdly, to make it possible in each individual member state within the European Union to get 20% of the use of transport fuel from renewable energies. It's very ambitious, but I'm quite sure that we will be able to manage. And it is very important that these targets are binding targets. If we can agree that it is binding targets, then there will be much more room, much more interest, and a much better climate for investing in bioenergy. And of course, this will mean a possibility as well for European and farmers all over the world, supported by the relevant measures. Specifically with regard to biofuels, for which I have some policy responsibility, two questions immediately pops up on the screen. First, can we hit this 10% target biofuel without putting excessive strain on our food markets? The Commission has been analyzing, and with all the figures that we have put into the machine now, it seems as if we will be able to do so. We think that this target price for agricultural raw materials would mean that the prices would increase between 3 and 6% for cereals and between 5 and 18% for major oil seeds. And we know that increases like that would only have a minor influence or impact on the final product, as the raw material is always a minor importance in the final price. So these estimates imply that we must make the best use of our domestic resources, and that we, of course, want to and have to respect a certain, sometimes significant level of imports. And the second question, can we guarantee that the biofuels used in Europe will not have an undesirable environmental consequence? Again, our analysis say that we can manage this, and we are working on a mechanism to achieve it. But of course, all this will have to be completely in line or in conformity with our WTO commitments. So to bring an end to my contribution today, I would, before others take over the lead in the wagon, I would just summarize shortly. In the European Union, we want our farmers to be prosperous. We want to get behind them in their efforts to compete and not stand in their way. And that's the reason for us to try to simplify our system. It's an ongoing exercise to make things more simple. We can do that through policy, and we are helping them to try to combine competitiveness with responsibility. And these efforts will work best when we see eye to eye internationally on what actually responsibility means. And let me be positive about prosperity. It doesn't have to mean capitalism red in tooth and claw. A farmer with a sauna in his house and a nice car in the driveway may also be able to maintain woodland and also growing energy crops. Show me the money, but let's also keep in sight all the other things that farmers do while they are doing their very best to make money. Thank you very much.